Today is Tuesday, October 2nd, the year 2001. We're in East Lansing, Michigan. I am Dr. Jeff Charnley, interviewing Dr. Waldo Keller for the MSU Oral History Project for the sesquicentennial of Michigan State to be commemorated in the year 2005. As you can see, Professor Keller, we've got a tape recorder here today. Do you give us permission to record this interview?
Yes, Jeff, I do.
I'd like to start first with some general questions about your personal educational background prior to college. Where were you born and raised, and where did you go to school before university?
Well, some people won't believe this, but I was born and raised in a small farming community in Ohio, northwest corner of Ohio, where my father was a veterinarian. Mm-hmm. The name of the town is Hicksville, Ohio. I was born there in 1929 and went to high school there and went on to college intending to be a veterinarian. I had an older brother, 3 years older, and we were very close, and he was at Ohio University, so I went down to Ohio University for 1 year to spend with him, and then I had to move up to Ohio State to finish my pre-veterinary curriculum, mm-hmm. and then entered veterinary school after the second year, and graduated then in 1953 from the Ohio State University.
Mm-hmm. So your father was an important influence in choosing that?
Yes. I grew up with veterinary medicine and loved animals and loved getting out with him. And
mm-hmm. How did he involve you in his practice?
Well, he let me jump in the car and go with him any time that I wanted to. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, when I got into veterinary college and went home, I got into some, really, he started to train me then, mm-hmm. give me some education mm-hmm. outside of school.
Were many of your classmates at Ohio State, did they come from that same background, or were they come from varied, or did they have parents that were also vets?
I had a couple classmates whose fathers were veterinarians, mm-hmm. But I can't recall of more than about two. And a good share of them were, well, this was right after the Second World War, mm-hmm. and there were about 60 in my class, and there were 10 of us that were not veterans. Mm-hmm. So the rest of the class was a mixed bag of people that had been through the war. They were a little older mm-hmm. and a little wiser, and came from mostly Ohio, out of West Virginia, and then quite a few from Indiana, because at that time Purdue did not have a veterinary college yet. Mm-hmm. So there was a substantial group of people that were from Indiana and returned there. So there were a lot of Ohio State graduates practicing in Indiana, mm-hmm. in the more central part of Indiana. A mm-hmm. lot of our Michigan State graduates also went to Indiana, and they congregated in the northern, populated the northern part of Indiana.
I see. Mm-hmm. Had your father gone to Ohio State?
He did. Mm-hmm. He went to Ohio State, but he didn't finish at Ohio State because there was a private college at Cincinnati. Mm. in those days, and he felt that that was a better clinical program than they had at Ohio State. Plus, he was running out of money, and he had a friend down there who got him a job as a motorcycle policeman in Cincinnati in 1915. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. he actually graduated from the private College of Veterinary Medicine at Cincinnati.
Mm-hmm. How would you describe his practice?
His practice was similar to the veterinarian who wrote All Things,
All Creatures Great and Small.
All Creatures Great and Small. It was a farm practice mainly, and he was just beginning to do a little bit of pet work, and he did whatever was necessary for people, but he didn't have a building or a small animal practice per se. Mm-hmm. But that part of the practice was just becoming into vogue. So it was strictly a small farm practice.
Mm-hmm. How did the Depression affect the practice?
Well, you know, there was not much money going around in those days, and the farming business was very poor. The effect was that we talked about this recently. We really didn't suffer, because all of my cousins were farmers, mm-hmm. so we had plenty of food. Mm-hmm. We had no lack of food. And growing up in those times, you didn't think about a lot of other things. You had what you had, and that was not much money. Mm-hmm. and we did not have a lot of material things, but that didn't seem to bother us. He was busy, but there was a lot of bartering. I remember finding a book that he had kept track with the man who owned the hardware store, whose name was Glenn Burgoyne, and he also had a farm and had animals on the farm. So I discovered this book in which there's a notation in there of a hammer and some nails and the price of it, and then under that, castration of pigs, the price of an equation at the end. And I think that's a lot of what was going on in those days, it was bartering.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. But how would you describe your undergraduate education?
Fun.
Yeah.
My brother was a little older, been in the Navy, and had gone through a couple of Navy training programs. He was a radar operator. Mm-hmm. And he had learned how to study. And I hadn't learned that at Hicksville High School. So he had to teach me that when I got to college, and also told me the importance of studying and learning, because you had to produce a certain level if expected to get into a professional college.
Mm-hmm.
It was fun. My mother was a music teacher, so I started playing the trumpet when I was a very small child. So I played in dance bands in high school, and so I immediately got a job with a band at Ohio University, and then when I went up to Ohio State, I also got in with a small group, and that was a way of course, making money.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a pretty good way of making money, because you could do it in a concentrated time on Fridays and Saturday nights, whereas other people had to have jobs that spread out through the whole week.
Mm-hmm. Had you considered becoming a professional musician? Or
yes, and my mother was very fearful that that's what I was going to do. But I played with some bands and took a couple road trips. And I decided after that second little road trip that playing music was a very good hobby, but having to live the way you did to make a living at just music, I wasn't prepared to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And I've never regretted that decision, because I don't think I would have ever been good enough to have been the top trumpet player in the country.
Mm-hmm.
I really just enjoy it.
Could we talk a little bit about your practice after you graduated? What did you do after you graduated?
Came to Michigan State. Mm-hmm. I had always intended to go back home and practice, relieve my father.
Mm-hmm.
I had a mentor at Ohio State. I lived in the clinic there for about 3 years and got to working with Dr. E.J. Catcott, who encouraged me, because he said, of all your interests that you have, you ought to try to think about being at a university. You don't really need to go back to Hicksville.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a tough decision, of course, to make. But in about February of my senior year, they had a big veterinary conference, and they sent two representatives up from Michigan State looking to interview potential candidates. They wanted to get outside of their own graduates here and look at somebody in small animal, in surgery mainly. And that had always interested me, and I'd spend a lot of extra time trying to learn to do surgery.
Mm-hmm.
And Dr. Catcott recommended me, and so he interviewed me. And I went back home and told my father that I really thought maybe I'd like to try a university life for a little while before I came back home. Now, at the same time, the Korean War was on, and we had a ROTC unit at Ohio State in the veterinary college. And I had applied for active duty, figuring to get that over with. And I was at that age when my brother was in the Second World War. I was just a little too young to go, and felt the need to donate some of my time to the military. So I had made this application and had been accepted already. So then this other thing came up, and I went back to the military and said, I have potential for a job. Would you postpone my enlistment for at least a year? And unbeknownst to me, somebody up there was really thinking about keeping people happy mm-hmm. if they went into the service. And they said, sure, we'll do that for you. So I took the job at Michigan State and came up here in July 1 of 1953 and told everybody here that I was planning to go in and serve my time in the military. And they said, that's fine. If it looks like at the end of the year you work out and we think we want to keep you, we'll put you on a leave of absence. And so that's what happened. I came up and for a year and I really liked it. And they gave me a leave of absence and I went into the, I was a veteran in the Strategic Air Corps.
Okay. In the Air Force?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Strategic Air Command.
Mm-hmm. Where did you serve?
I served, my first serve was in Savannah, Georgia for a short time, but then I kept asking for an overseas assignment since I was still single, and they finally gave it to me and sent me to French Morocco, mm-hmm. to Sidi Slimane, where we had a base, and I spent a year in French Morocco, came back and finished out my tour at Westover, Massachusetts, and then I returned to Michigan State.
West Side was not far from Springfield, is it?
Right, right. Just outside of Springfield.
Uh-huh. Yeah. You were working as a vet, is that right?
Yes. Yeah. The Strategic Air Command, of course, had Kurt LeMay, General LeMay, was protecting the world at that time. We uh-huh. had airplanes in the air all the time, day and night, uh-huh. and they did have the A-bomb. And so we had a lot of security on these bases, and all the security was done by the military police with guard dogs. Mm-hmm. And between two bases in French Morocco and the air, the radar sites out at the edge of the Sahara Desert, I had over 150 dogs that I was in charge of, mm-hmm. Air Command. Plus the veterinary service, because of our background in meat inspection and public health, with the public health officers, and we're in charge of food, actually, and food storage, and water purification. And we brought a bunch of things from the natives, and those all had to be inspected and source inspected, so I got out around and saw some of the countryside and how they raised vegetables in the desert, mm-hmm. which they did successfully, the French did. Mm-hmm. So it was a very interesting experience.
Mm-hmm. What breeds were the guard dogs?
All German Shepherds.
All German Shepherds.
Wow. Yeah.
Were there any special problems that they had in the desert that they might not have encountered other areas?
No, and I was always surprised because when I got over there, we had dermatitis cases, and I thought, well, certainly in an arid, dry climate like this with the temperature constantly in the 90s, mm-hmm. We're going to see a lot of problems. But we had the groomers brush these dogs out every day. They got very good care. And that was the healthiest bunch of animals that I've ever been around.
Is that right? Was there anything from your time overseas that you learned or later on that you came to value?
Well, I worked with a lot of different people, and I was in French Morocco at the time that Morocco turned back from French rule to Arabic rule, and Muley Hassan was brought back out of exile. It was a very interesting time politically. Having been out then in the countryside and watched this operation, because there was shooting going on around our base, they had a little civil war here and there, mm-hmm. and looking at the way that population lived has given me a little bit of understanding of the problems that we have continuously had at the eastern end of the Mediterranean, and why we can't resolve some of the problems that we've had, and those continue on now.
Mm-hmm. When you did you maintain any contacts with Michigan State during your time over there? Or
oh yes, I had a couple of people that I wrote to, mm-hmm. and they'd inform me as to what was going on and what kind of changes were going on.
Mm-hmm. Who was the dean when you were first?
Dean Clark.
Clark?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, a very interesting man who had a big background in Michigan agriculture and Michigan public health. And, he was a very good dean.
When you came back, what were your, was there much, did you experience any culture shock or anything like that?
No, I got back to Westover, and that cured the culture shock from French Morocco there. But surprisingly, in just the, I was gone 2.5 years, there hadn't been that many changes going on. Michigan State was beginning to grow. When I got back, it was obvious that I, probably if I was going to stay in academia, I needed to get another degree, a master's degree at least, if I was going to remain a clinician. Mm-hmm. And so I started in doing a master's degree in January, and my appointment didn't come back until July 1. Mm-hmm. So I had the GI Bill, so I went to school here full time, got a master's degree, and at that time I was very interested already in the eye, and got with a Dr. Esther Smith and Dr. Calhoun. Dr. Calhoun was the chairman of anatomy, and between she and Dr. Smith, they also ran the medical technology program, which was a part of veterinary medicine's responsibilities in those days. And she was doing tissue culture work, and that fascinated me. So I did work under her and got my master's degree. Got most of it done before I went back on the job on July 1.
Mm-hmm. How was it that you became interested in the eye?
Well, I got very interested in surgery, and I was teaching surgery, and the smaller it got, the better I liked it.
Oh, really?
And there were no veterinary ophthalmologists, and I did have a number of eye problems that came in. So there was a Dr. Art Schultz, who was a well-known human ophthalmologist in this area, whose son, incidentally, now is a veterinarian. He told me that I could come over and work with him and watch him do surgery, and he'd come over and watch me and help me along, so he did. And that really got me very interested in doing eye work. And since there were no veterinary ophthalmologists, I got a lot of cases sent to me. And by the time 1965 came around, I was interested enough that I was looking for some way that I might get some additional training. And we had a graduate of many years ago, Seymour Roberts, who's now dead, but he was a fascinating individual, very intelligent. He was interested in the eyes, and he was one of about four veterinarians in the country that were proclaiming themselves as ophthalmologists and were trying to do some specialty practice. And he was in California and had developed a close rapport with the ophthalmologists at Stanford Medical School. And they were interested in comparative ophthalmology, so they established a fellowship out there. And a close friend of mine was out there in the first one that they had. And I talked with him, and then I talked with Dr. Roberts, and talked with my colleagues here, and they all said, hey, why don't you go out there and be a veterinary ophthalmologist? Mm-hmm. So I did. I took a leave of absence for a year in 1965, went to Stanford Medical School as a fellow, and that was a very excellent experience for me. I went out there with a wife and one child that was 1 year old, one that was 2 years old.
In California.
In California, yes.
It was an exciting time out there too.
It was, yes. Well, when I came back, then I really wanted to do just ophthalmology, but I still had to teach surgery. Mm-hmm. And so I did continue doing that and got to work with an internationally known orthopedic surgeon that we had here, Dr. Wade Brinker. He brought a lot of honor and respect to the college and the university. And Wade and I, as a matter of fact, got involved with television when television first was available and taught the first courses by television, surgery laboratory part of the course. We saw, we taught by live television. There was no tape in those early days. And because of the interest and facilities that weren't available yet, they set up the first television studio. Actually, was in Giltner Hall. And the main lecture hall there was wired for television. I think that's probably the first hall at the university that was wired for television. So we were teaching by television at a very early time, and continued that interest, and that was an exciting time.
Yeah. Was that interested in technological education and TV being an early one? Were there any other on campus that were involved in that or interested in it, or would you say that
some people in education?
Okay.
Yeah. Yes. There were a group of people that were beginning to get interested in it. Mm-hmm.
Was it broadcast, or how was it?
It was broadcast live to only a few rooms.
Okay.
Didn't have any cable across the campus.
Right.
So it was Giltner Hall. I think was the first hall that was wired to do that.
Okay.
So they brought classes in from other places to use that lecture hall.
Mm-hmm.
And so we got them to bring a camera right down to our surgery lab so that we could perform the surgery, and then the students could go right to the laboratory and mm-hmm. and do it.
Mm-hmm. At what point did they get taping capability? Or?
It was probably at least 5 years.
Oh, really?
Yeah, before we really had videotape mm-hmm. available. So we had to really try to do some innovative things. Like I wanted to teach the students how to make an incision right down the midline of the abdomen, the most mm-hmm. common incision for spaying dogs and cats. So I had a friend, Roger Brown, who was had been a practitioner and then was a PhD in anatomy. And he was teaching in anatomy. So we got him to set up two cameras, one with a cadaver and one with the live animal. Of course, we had them both surgically draped.
Mm-hmm.
And then he would go through the first incision through the cadaver, and of course there was no bleeding. And I would make the first incision, and then while I'm stopping the bleeding, getting those vessels all tied off, Roger would go ahead and demonstrate on the other camera, number two, the incision and the cadaver, and then he could show the layers, and we could go through it layer by layer. And we thought that was quite innovative.
How would you describe the, when you were assistant professor, how would you describe the MSU vet school overall?
Average.
Average.
Yes. Yes. One of the things that, when I first came here in 1953, President Hanna personally interviewed every new faculty member. And so I went over and I talked with Dr. Hanna, and he impressed on me that we were a young university and that the College of Veterinary Medicine was even younger than the university. And he could foresee great things for the university and for the profession. And he was only interested in people that had some vision and some foresight of what to do in the future and how to make it better. And that always impressed me. And I thought that I was surrounded by colleagues that were doing that. And so I think that was a great stimulus to me throughout my time here at Michigan State to try to do things that would be out on the cutting edge and getting some new programs started. And we were able to do that. So we did start to grow. At that time, Dr. Willis Armistead was the dean. And I, being young and brash and back from my experience at the medical school in California, I kept pushing him and saying, you know, I was convinced that the way that we would become one of the best colleges of veterinary medicine was to pursue specialization in all areas, in large animal and small animal. We had to have the research going on here, and we had to have the best clinicians here. And I kept hammering at him with that, and after about 2 years, he brought me in and he said, you know, if you really believe that this is what we have to do, then you got to figure out how to do it. So he said, I'll give you a chance to put your money where your mouth is, and made me chairman of the department. And some of the first things that I did was to help establish an internship and intern residency programs, because we really didn't have any well-trained specialists. They were mostly self-trained and worked together. And so I felt that we needed to start some formal advanced training. So we did that. And we were one of the first universities, one of the first colleges then to have a formal internship and a formal residency program. Mm-hmm.
How did you find the vets in the area, or let's say in Michigan, were they receptive to that idea?
Very much. And we've had a very progressive group of practitioners in the state, and we've always worked very closely together. But the association was formed, the American Animal Hospital Association, and that was mainly the result of practitioners here in Michigan. And they pretty well ran that organization for the first 10 years of its existence. And they organized that with the sole goal of increasing the quality of veterinary care for pets. So they went right along with what I was trying to do, and supported it and helped push some of their friends on board members, because we had to have a little more money. And fortunately, this all came about during some of those expansive years of the 70s. Mm-hmm. So money was available, and we did get those programs started, and we have continued with that. And our intern residency programs here, I would have to say right now, are considered the best in the country. Yeah. And our graduates have gone to most all of the universities around the country as specialists.
Now, what was the clinic or your department called at that time? This was in the mid-60s?
Yes, right after I was made chairman, in discussions with the dean and with the other people, at that time we had a surgery and clinics, and medicine and clinics. So we had two of us that were chairman of departments in which we shared all these faculty. Made it about impossible to really develop the programs we made. So we changed the names of the programs and made them small animal surgery and medicine and large animal surgery and medicine. And I think that was a very beneficial move. It was an obvious move, mm-hmm. and the faculty were not going across the board too much. As specialists, we do cross the board. As a veterinary ophthalmologist, I, of course, look at all species of animals.
Mm-hmm. Not that you would know the exact statistics, but how would you say that this change affected the numbers that came as students?
I don't think that had an impact. Mm. Students, you know, don't look at the depth of the program that much. But there was an influx of interest in veterinary medicine. And the student number, we were getting more and more applicants. And we slowly went from 60 students to 100 students. And now it's, I think this year's class, well, I know this year's class is 105. Mm-hmm. Back in those early days, there was one or two women here or there. And I have a statistic here someplace that I thought was quite interesting, in that by 1976, MSU had graduated more women than any veterinary college in the United States and Canada. We graduated 252 women. Cornell had graduated 93. This was by 1976. Then in the 80s, more and more women started making application to the college, and the numbers in the classes increased tremendously. And this year's class, this is a surprising statistic, there are 98 women and 5 men in the current class. I think that that's a higher percentage than would be an average around the country, but the trend is there. I understand the trend is the same in medicine.
Mm-hmm.
We thought that a lot of this might have come after all creatures great and small came about, but I'm not sure that, that's the reason. Mm-hmm. We do have a national application service now, so that 17 of the 28 veterinary colleges are part of this, which Michigan State is a part. And so people can, from all over the country, can in fact make applications. So once the application's up higher, you have a larger group that you select from. But we still maintain less than 25% from out of state. And that's about where we are.
Mm-hmm.
But I think statistics would say that of the people that are applying, the women obviously have some very good scores. The other thing in our profession, in the early years, there's a lot of manual labor associated mm-hmm. with it, handling the animals.
And with large animal or
yes,
large
animal. Mm-hmm. And now with a lot of the people going to small animal, they're not handling those animals. Plus, we have other ways to handle them now with all of the medications and all the drugs. I mean, we can inject an elephant and have him lay down and go to sleep, which we couldn't do years ago. So the pharmaceutical industry has been very helpful in giving us an armamentarium to not only treat disease, but to handle mm-hmm. the animals.
What, in terms of your administration, when you were chair, would you talk a little bit about your administrative duties?
Well,